May it please the court. My name is Mary Bullard, registration number 39382, and I represent the defendant, Mr. Anthony Jones. Anthony informed the police that his involvement in this incident that led to the charges in this case began when his brother, Oldon, called him and asked him for help. Oldon told Anthony that Jennifer Frazier, Anthony's former live-in girlfriend, had neglected to pay $40 for some crack cocaine. After Oldon provided the drugs, he discovered that the parcel of money he had obtained from Ms. Frazier was in fact only $1 bill wrapped around a lot of paper. So since Anthony knew Ms. Frazier well, based on their former relationship, Oldon hoped that Anthony would be able to convince her to pay up. Anthony called and spoke with Ms. Frazier several times about her debt, advising her that it would be in her best interest to pay the money owed, and Ms. Frazier agreed to do so. However, when Ms. Frazier failed to show up at the appointed time and place, Anthony and Oldon decided to see if they could find her. Eventually, they arrived at the home of Mr. Robert Wells, who is Ms. Frazier's brother. And Ms. Frazier initially refused to speak with the men. So Anthony and Oldon left the home, and shortly thereafter, a man Anthony had never before met, but who was an acquaintance of his brother, Oldon, joined them. And it was a very cold day, and the man was wearing a black face mask that showed only his eyes. He was also wearing a large puffy coat with a long shirt underneath and baggy pants.
When was this?
I believe it was in January.
I'm sorry?
I think it was in January. And this man was subsequently identified as Kinteris Lundy. Anthony Oldon and Mr. Lundy returned to the residence of Ms. Frazier's brothers. Standing on the porch with the two other men, Anthony calmly explained to Ms. Frazier's brothers that they were there to see Ms. Frazier regarding the debt, a debt of $40. And Anthony suggested that if Ms. Frazier did not have the money, that perhaps her brothers could pay it, could pay Oldon on her behalf. And the brother stated that, they could not speak with Ms. Frazier. However, Ms. Frazier then appeared at the door, and they spoke. Mr. Wells, who was also at the door at the time, testified that he did not feel threatened by Mr. Anthony. He'd known him before, and Anthony had remained calm throughout the entire conversation. So Mr. Wells was instead really concerned about the man who was wearing this mask. He asked the man why he was wearing the mask, and the man told him and asked him to take off the mask, but the man refused and said, "Well, it's cold, don't worry about it." And Mr. Wells then closed the front door and decided that he was going to go and get the money to pay the men. He went to his bedroom to obtain the money. He came back, and as he opened the door, he saw the masked man drawing a gun out of the front of his pants. And as Mr. Wells quickly jumped back, slamming the door closed, the masked man fired into the door frame approximately 2 feet above the ground. However, no one was injured. Mr. Wells testified that he was not previously aware that the man in the mask had a gun because of his apparel and the fact that it was large and baggy and covered the area from which he pulled the gun. Mr. Frazier would be the other brother who was at the door, similarly testified he did not see a weapon. And Anthony, when he spoke with police, denied knowing that the masked man was armed or that he intended to shoot the weapon. So Anthony noted that he was standing by the door and could himself have been struck by a bullet. At trial, the prosecution conceded that the evidence clearly showed that it was Mr. Lundy who was the individual who had fired the weapon. So they proceeded on the theory, largely based on complicity. The major errors, there were several major errors that occurred, but I think I'd like to focus today on the misconduct and closing argument. First of all, the prosecution argued without any record support or basis in fact that Anthony was defined as a human being, as a person, by his choice to, quote, sell crack cocaine, broker this crack cocaine. As the trial court reminded prosecution upon an objection by defense counsel, the evidence presented was that Oldon, not Anthony, had sold the cocaine. And so even after being reminded of this and asked to rephrase his argument, the prosecution continued to refer to Mr. Jones as a person who sold drugs, repeating an unsubstantiated allegation that the prosecution had in fact made an opening argument as well. The prosecution then continued to argue that it was clear from Mr. Jones' statement that he brokered that deal. In fact, in Mr. Jones' statements to police, which are part of the record as an exhibit, a taped exhibit, he repeatedly noted that he did not learn of the drug deal until days after the fact. So the prosecution's statement that Mr. Jones has somehow confessed to having been a drug dealer or having brokered a cocaine deal.
And Mr. Jones suggested or responded to his ex-girlfriend's inquiry about where she could get drugs. Hadn't he previously responded by saying, from my brother?
He learned from his brother that this cocaine deal had occurred, but he did not know that the cocaine deal had occurred until he heard from his brother that she had not paid up, according to his statement. Now, according to Detective Mahalko's testimony at trial, the brother, Mr. Wells, stated that, well, it's unclear whether it was Mr. Wells, but the detective, his testimony basically starts out, he's saying, I learned from Mr. Wells XYZ. And as he continues, because it's a very long paragraph, it's very unclear as to where he gathers this information, he comes to the conclusion that apparently Anthony had asked his brother Oldon to take care of the deal. But it's unclear where he arrives at that conclusion or if that's something that Mr. Wells told him or where that comes from exactly, or if that's just his supposition. But in any event, that's not something that Mr. Jones ever confessed to, and that would be the error.
Well, we're not bound by what Mr. Jones confessed to if there's other evidence that would support a reasonable inference that he might have been involved in setting up this transaction, are we?
The problem would be the misrepresentation of the prosecution that Mr. Jones, it is clear from Mr. Jones' own statement that he brokered the deal, and that is not what Mr. Jones said. But more importantly, whether or not there is evidence that Mr. Jones, in fact, brokered the deal, which is very unclear, I would argue, from the record, the prosecution could not go on and argue that Mr. Jones was a crack cocaine dealer, a part of a Jones family crack cocaine business that simply went far above and beyond the pale and painted Mr. Jones as a career criminal, which there was no evidence to support. And basically, the prosecution argued that his character could be inferred from his decision to sell drugs, to be a member of a drug dealing family business, and his role as a crack cocaine dealer, of which there was no evidence to support it in the record, but this statement of Detective Mahalko, which is very limited, and again, we don't know exactly where his deduction that, in fact, Mr. Jones, we don't know where he came, how he came to the conclusion that, in fact, Mr. Jones asked his brother to take care of this crack cocaine.
But does it matter where it came if there was no objection to that particular evidence, and if it was admitted without objection, does it matter where it came from?
I don't believe that statement in and of itself, no matter where it came from, is enough for the prosecution to argue that he is a member of a family crack cocaine dealing business. Assuming that he did, in fact, broker this one deal, does that make it a business? Does that make him a drug dealer? Does that make him a person who sells crack cocaine when, in fact, he did not ever, there's no evidence that he, in fact, sold the crack cocaine, but his brother may have sold it, but he, in fact, did not? The issue here is that the prosecution is arguing, based on these other acts, which are in unrelated, uncharged crimes to the one that he's accused of participating in here, that he has a criminal character, that he is the kind of person who would do violent acts, who would do such an act as, he compared him to Tony Soprano, saying this is the kind of man who would basically, who operates in a different world than we do. He's a part of a family business. And like Tony Soprano will, you know, stop at nothing to take care of his family's crime business, even so going so far as to engage in violent acts. And that, to me, is beyond the pale. They're trying to distract the jury with an argument about someone's criminal nature and criminal character, when in fact they should be restricting themselves to the facts and the evidence presented at trial. And I believe that the argument here went far beyond that. And when you're comparing people to notorious fictional crime family members, you're distracting the jury from really the case at hand. And moreover, the issue here was Mr. Jones's credibility, because we're talking about Mr. Jones having made statements about what his knowledge and his intent were. And in a complicity case, we're dealing with whether or not he shared the intent of the man who fired the weapon or who pulled the weapon from his pants, whether he knew the gun was there, whether he shared the intent of him to fire the weapon or to wield the weapon in any way in order to threaten someone. And there's really no evidence in the record that I can see that would support that argument, given the fact that Mr. Frazier himself could not tell that the guy was armed, that he had not, that the evidence presented was that he did not know the man at all, and had never met him before, and had no way of knowing that he was in fact armed with a deadly weapon, let alone that he would then take the deadly weapon and use it when he was about to get paid.
He didn't know he was about to get paid.
Perhaps.
He knew the door was closed, and he didn't know that they were about to get paid. Now, the brother may have known they were about to get paid, but nobody announced, or there's no evidence that anyone announced that we're coming back to pay you.
That's true. But there's no evidence that Anthony knew that this man had the gun and was going to pull it out because the door had shut.
There's no direct evidence. What about the suggestions like, well, or he had stated to the ex-girlfriend, like, well, I can't do anything, but you never know what someone my brother knows might do, combined with, gee, they're going to meet someone the brother knows, mm-hmm. combined with the defendant's admission that, yeah, I thought he was dangerous, and he might do something stupid. What could a jury infer from all those things that defendant did know that he was armed?
It is a close case, I believe, based on all those small little pieces, perhaps. But again, the dangerous comment came after he knew the man had fired a weapon. He had not met the man before. And if you make some statement saying, well, I don't know what somebody could do, that's not the same thing as saying, well, I don't know if someone's going to, that could mean someone's going to do, who knows what. It doesn't mean they're necessarily going to pull out a weapon.
Is it for the jury to determine under all the circumstances what
true.
Was
true. A jury that's not tainted by improper prosecutorial argument. Here we have a prosecutor. The issue here is his credibility, and the prosecutor is arguing this man is a liar. He's a liar by nature. He lied to the police. He lied again and again. And now he's going to, you know, even if he said, well, we'll probably never get Anthony Jones to say yes, that this is what I intended. He could lie about that anyway. The prosecutor is arguing that Mr. Jones is a liar by nature. That, combined with the fact that he's a criminal, he's a member of a criminal family business, he's a drug dealer, implying that this is not something he has only done once, but something he's done multiple times, of which there is no evidence, that he sells drugs, which again, there is no evidence. The whole nature of the prosecutor's argument is that this is a bad guy, and consequently, you should convict him, because if he is a drug dealer, and if he's a liar, then odds are he did this thing. But that's a propensity argument, and it's impermissible, and it wasn't proper here.
But what does it matter that the jury acquitted Mr. Jones on most of the charges? Does it suggest that the jury was not carried away by or inflamed at all by any of this comment?
I don't believe it does. I believe it shows that the jury determined perhaps that on some counts it wasn't going to convict, but I believe that but for the prosecutor's misconduct in closing and the other errors that occurred, it might have acquitted Mr. Jones of all of the charges. And but for the fact that they're being told that this man is a drug dealer, et cetera, they think they at least have to convict him of something. Obviously, there's something wrong here. He's a bad guy. That's what the prosecutor keeps arguing. So to say that, well, they acquitted him of all these other things, so consequently, you know, it had no effect, I don't believe you can reach that conclusion, given that we do have a verdict here of guilty on one count that is, again, dependent on the man's credibility, which was unfairly undermined by the prosecutor's argument. And then there are obviously problems having to do with a solicitation of inadmissible lay testimony regarding statements that Mr. Jones allegedly made. There's problems having to do with the failure to permit the defendant's theory of defense, but I'll just ask that this court reverse.
Let me ask you on the theory of defense, what's the difference between the proposed theory of the defense instruction and a general denial of guilt?
The difference here is that Mr. Jones alleged that he did not know that there was a gun. And in other words, he alleged a fact upon which to base his denial of any knowledge of Mr. Lundy's intent. If he did not know he had a gun, it's more likely that he did not know that he intended to use that gun with which to threaten someone.
isn't that, though, just a refutation of the elements of either the crime or of the complicity elements?
It is a statement of fact which supports his acquittal. It's a statement of law and fact, which is supported by the evidence, which is not a restatement of a general denial. A general denial, it would be simply, I did not know of his intent, period. That's not what he said. He said, I didn't know of his intent because I didn't know that he was armed with a weapon. Thanks.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. I really don't have anything to add to what's in my brief, but I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
Yeah, how about prosecutorial misconduct during closing argument? You know, the idea that, gee, wait a minute, there was no evidence that he was a crack cocaine dealer or a drug dealer or in the family business. Or how about distinguishing the case from Wendt as far as why it's not plain error, okay, you know, to use the L word so many times in closing arguments. So I think there are a couple issues we're interested in hearing from you about.
I'll start with the first comment. That when the prosecutor made the first comment saying that the defendant sold crack cocaine, immediately there was an objection. Immediately the prosecutor rephrased that and said it was clear from Mr. Jones' statement that he brokered the deal. And then went on to say the evidence in support of that. And I'll tell you, I can't remember specifically what the defendant said during his interview, because it's been a long time since I've seen that. But I do recall he said statements in that videotaped interview, either directly or suggesting that he had in fact helped arrange the drug deal. So I think that cured any possible error. The prosecutor did not go on then to call the defendant a crack cocaine dealer. She did say he was in the business, the family business of doing it, that his brother was the one to sell the drugs and he was the one to help collect the debt. And I do think that's a reasonable inference from the evidence here.
And because of one time that he may have helped collect a debt, he's in a family business? Is that a reasonable inference?
Yes, I think it is a reasonable inference. And this is a plain error situation when it comes to that comment. And I don't think that there's anything there that makes that so fundamentally unfair to the outcome of the trial. And the Tony Soprano comment, maybe not the best cultural reference to bring in, but I think if you read what the prosecutor was saying, she was saying, and I guess only somebody who watched the show would be familiar with the reference, when Tony Soprano killed his nephew Christopher, he didn't want to do it, but he thought it was necessary. And I think that was the point she was trying to make. As I said, I don't think it was the best cultural reference to use, but again, I don't think it rises to the level of plain error.
About the fact that the seven references to lie, after there have been several Supreme Court decisions saying, don't say lie, and she did it repeatedly, how do we deal with that?
I think it is improper, but it's obviously improper to call the defendant a liar and to say he lied, but I think we can distinguish this case from Wendt. In Wendt, everything turned on the defendant's credibility. She was the only living witness to the crime. She claimed she shot the victim in self-defense. And this lie theme in Wendt started in opening statements, went throughout the trial. In questioning witnesses, and the defendant lied to you there. So we had it go from the beginning to the end of trial, and the word was used dozens of times, as I recall, in Wendt, calling her a liar and saying she lied. Here, in contrast, the prosecutor only used the term seven times. She mainly used it when discussing the evidence in support of the attempted murder charge, and this wasn't a case that solely turned on the defendant's credibility. We had other witnesses, we had other evidence here, the text messages, things like that. So it wasn't a case where his defense solely depended on his own credibility.
Oh, but his defense didn't depend on his credibility, because that was the only evidence to support his defense, wasn't it? Other than the lack of any direct testimony that he said he knew that the guy had a gun, or that the masked man said he told him that he had a gun. I mean, it's just really, it relies on his testimony, doesn't it?
Well, he didn't testify. It does rely.
I mean, his statement, excuse me.
It doesn't solely rely on his credibility the way it did and when. She was the only one there that was living that could testify, that could say, here's what happened and here's why I acted in self-defense and this is what I did. Here we have the text messages. We have other witnesses to the crime who can talk about what happened. So it doesn't solely hinge, his defense doesn't solely hinge on his own version of what occurred.
Distinguish the case from Wilson.
I can't do that right now. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I was prepared to distinguish it from Wend, and I was thinking in terms of Wend, and I agreed these comments were improper, but I don't think in this case, and considering the outcome of this case, I don't think that it's reversible error. But I, as I said, I acknowledge that the line comments are improper.
Considering the outcome of the case, you don't think it's reversible error. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? I may have missed what you meant.
Often, when I read the record, most of the prosecutor's references to lying and liar had to do with the attempted, when she was talking about the elements of attempted murder and conspiracy. And so I don't think that really influenced the jury because they acquitted of those charges. That's primarily her comments were directed to the evidence in support of the charges of which he was acquitted.
What about the comment, and I, again, I, you know, hadn't read it over the weekend, so I may be a little off with my comment, but what about the comment like, and if he were here, we wouldn't know if he would lie again? I mean, remember, I think the prosecutor made a statement about kind of like, we wouldn't know if whether he would or could lie again.
Did they perk?
If he were to talk to us now, something like that.
That proves intent. Intent equals guilt. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll probably never get Anthony Jones to say, yes, that's what I intended. He could lie about that anyway. The bottom line is when you look at what somebody intends and what they say you did, it all comes together.
Okay. What kind of response do you have to that comment?
It's improper. It was an improper comment, but I don't think I don't think it's a when situation. And that's all I can say about it. It's improper, but I don't think it's reversible error.
Questions on any?
Thank you.
It's up all your time, Ms. Bullard. Oh, I apologize for that then. I thank you both for your arguments. They were excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and opinion will issue in due course.